Welcome to another episode of the Growth Focus podcast, where we bring together tech leaders from all across the globe to share their insights and their expertise to help us grow within our industry. My name is Gary Lafter, your host, CEO and founder of the Authority Accelerator, where we drive profits for tech companies by elevating experts in their field into authorities to their field so that the clients can come to them as opposed to them chasing clients. On this episode, I'm extremely pleased and honored to have Alexander Pfeiffer, and we're going to be talking all things about crowded markets, sustainability, and much, much more. So make sure you've got your pen and paper, make sure you're listening, and make sure you take plenty of notes. So let's have some fun. Alex, it's great to have you here. It's an absolute honor. Thank you for your time today. Why don't we start off by giving us a brief history of who you are and what is it that you do?
Thank you very much, Gary. I really appreciate being on your podcast, and thanks for having me. Yeah, happy to start and happy to introduce myself. So my name is Alexander Pfeiffer. I'm currently the co-founder and the CEO of Terralytic, a company that helps other companies reduce their supply chain emissions. And this topic, sustainability and carbon emissions, has really, it's a red thread through my life. I have very early on, straight out of university, decided that this is really what I want to focus my career on. Early on in my first life as an investment banker, I had some touch points to the effect that climate change can have on communities and on commodities. And I started really looking into this topic, and I realized that climate change is probably one of the defining issues and challenges of our time. And it was about then, by now probably 15 years ago, that I decided that this is what I want to focus on. So I joined McKinsey briefly after that moment as a consultant, and spent really most of my career there helping companies in and around the energy transition, starting with solar cells, working for utilities, but always on topics around like how do we navigate away from a high carbon to a low carbon economy. I took some time off at McKinsey to do my PhD in Oxford. At the time, I felt that it gave me a lot more credibility and almost like the license to operate in that field, because my original master's was in business, and oftentimes that didn't feel like the right background. I wrote my dissertation on stranded assets in the energy sector, so what happens to all that dirty infrastructure if we transition away from a high carbon economy. And then I had to decide whether I wanted to go back to McKinsey or do something else. And at the time, I realized that academia was an interesting and a very relevant moment of my life, but it was also incredibly slow. Mm-hmm. I remember this moment when I was writing on a book chapter with my supervisor, and it took between the first draft and publication about 5 years. And I realized this is not fast for me. So I ended up going back to McKinsey. I worked a lot around energy transition, and then more specifically decarbonization. I did, quote unquote, help found an internal startup at McKinsey. It's called a solution. It's McKinsey's version of an internal startup. And I helped growing that team from 5 to 130 people over the course of 3 years. And I think this is where I really discovered my love for entrepreneurship.
Well, that's what I really want to talk to you about first and foremost is you obviously had a great career. You're very knowledgeable and whatever. So how did you go from entrepreneurship at McKinsey, helping a company grow from there, to starting your own? Obviously, you got the bug on that. But what would you say was the deciding factor where you said, do you know what? I'm going to go out and do it alone.
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say it was the moment when I realized that it wasn't a startup anymore. And I think it, by all means and measures, 130 people is probably in the free market still considered a startup. I think within a company like McKinsey or any other big corporation, you become too big. Suddenly there's a lot of admin. There's a lot of, you transition away from someone who builds something to someone who manages something. And I did not enjoy that. I was very grateful for the support we got and also the interest we got internally. But I also realized that there was a lot more red tape. There was a lot more structure. There was a lot more things and rules that I had to follow. When you're a small 5-person team, there's a lot of entrepreneurialism that you can do and a lot of decisions you can take. When you're a 130-person team with a big budget, you can't do that anymore. So for my co-founder and I, this was the moment when we said, this was a great journey and we are very grateful for it, but this is now the moment to go out there, leave the shallow water, go into the deep water and try it ourselves.
Yeah, and that's the key thing, because then you go from one lesson to, and I love what you just said about going into the deep waters. You know, you've got the safety of the shallow waters. Now you're going out into the deep waters. And we've talked before about, you know, the ups and downs of a startup, you know, and we've talked about the scaling too fast and then having to recalibrate. Well, why don't we talk a little bit about that, you know, about, you know, coming out, you come out the gates really, really fast. You've got the full intentions of doing what you want to do and then going, whoa, you know, we're going too fast here. Let's take a step back and just, in your words, recalibrate. Let's talk us through that a little bit.
Yeah. And thanks for bringing this up. In our previous conversations, we've touched upon this. I'm happy to also share this here with your listeners. I think when you come out of a company, let's say on an intrapreneurialism or an intrapreneurial position, oftentimes the measure for success is not necessarily revenue or profit. There's a lot of other measures for success in a large corporate political environment. And I think a specific one I want to bring up is like team size. The bigger your team, the bigger the organization that you lead, the better. And yes, there's always revenue targets, et cetera, but in an internal market that is somewhat easier to achieve. I think when we started Terralytic, we were still very much riddled with the mindset from our intrapreneurial position. And we collected some money from angel investors and we took that money and we hired a team and we grew in that time, you know, in our first year, we grew to 14 people and we spent a lot of time picking the right people. And I love the people that we had in the team, but we grew too quick. We expected sales cycles to be shorter than they actually are in this market. So the revenue growth stayed behind the team growth. And I think it took us too long in the beginning to realize that. It took us too long to make then the decision to stop that and to perhaps also revert some of that. And that was certainly a learning that I expected a lot of learnings. That was not one of them, but it was an important one that we made.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is when you have the human element to it as well. You know, we're taught as entrepreneurs, make our minds up quickly and change them slowly. But that's different and harder when you are dealing with people and people's emotions and friendships and leadership. It does make, and this is why, you know, although you say it took too long to do it, there are reasons why. Yeah, there are absolutely reasons why. You're in the sustainability, and I want to talk about this crowded market. Sustainability is made very much of a buzzword today. There's a lot going on. We've talked about this before. There's a lot of competition out there. How do you position your company to stand out amongst the hundreds claiming they do exactly the same thing?
Yeah, this is a huge challenge. And I honestly wouldn't claim that we found a solution to that yet. We're still experimenting. We're still looking for it. But it is a bit what you say, right? So when we started with Terralytic, actually, even before leaving McKinsey, I started a list. Every time I came across a company that did something similar to us or what I had in mind, I took note and wrote down that company. I think when that list reached 100, I stopped. Because as they say, most startups die of suicide rather than murder, right? So I stopped tracking that. But this is just to say there's a huge market and it's a very competitive industry. I think if you look behind the curtains, then the industry itself is still very immature. So some of the industry standards are actually pretty low. I'll give you an example, but still very much a standard today is the so-called spend-based accounting. So rather than asking how much did I buy of something, you ask how much did I spend on it? And then you use some sort of average emission factor that says like per dollar spent on electrical equipment from North America, it's about 3 kilograms of CO2. I'm making this up. But obviously that is heavily biased depending on the prices you negotiate with your suppliers, inflation, discounts, et cetera, right? This is industry standard. Like if you do that, you follow industry standard, but it's obviously very bad. And most companies out there follow those standards. And we believe as Terralytic that there's a better way to do that. Now to more specifically answer your question, we try to really focus on what we're doing different than our competitors, and we constantly work on our value proposition and the communications around it. In fact, every 2 weeks, we have a meeting, the whole team gets together, we discuss every single customer conversation, every single sales conversation we had in that period, and we ask, what do they want? What are their pain points, right? And how do we help them differently than others do it? And then we use that to adjust our product roadmap, our communication, marketing, etc. We start seeing some success. So we start seeing inbound, which is great as a startup when you get the first sort of the first submissions via your website form that are not spam, but actually customers wanting a demo. That's amazing. But I think still the best effect that we have is talking in person to people, and that you do on conferences. And that's something that we do a lot. In fact, next 2 weeks, I'll be at two conferences in London and Frankfurt. I hope to talk to many potential customers, but it's obviously very difficult to scale. So we still need to figure out our digital marketing in a way that leads to more inbound. But it's a journey, and we're excited to see some progress.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm really pleased to hear, you know, that the progress is coming every single day for you. And I love hearing things like that, because there's absolutely no doubt that once you get in front of your potential clients, your platform speaks for itself. It's very unique. It really does work. But obviously, one of the challenges is how do you get people to trust you first, to have those conversations in order for you to show them what you have? And it's not just you. There's people here listening to this podcast, which would be saying exactly the same thing. I have something really good, but I just can't get that first conversation to show how good it is. What experiences have you had around that? And what have you done to get around that?
Yeah, honestly, persistence. It's coming from a world where the name of my company is sort of a very prestigious one, right? So the name McKinsey, think about them what you want, and many people think negative, some people think positive, but like it is a name that it's a household name in the corporate world, and it opens doors. Teralytic, nobody has ever heard of them, and nobody cares, at least not now. So the only way to get around it is persistence. So I'll give you a very concrete example. There was, I can't name the company. It's a large manufacturing company, one of the global leaders. And I've been trying to get a meeting with them for months. And I think I almost start feeling dirty, sending all these cold emails and LinkedIn requests, etc. But I continued. And eventually they answered and said, like, look, we've done a market scan. We looked at over 100 companies like you. If I'm taking a meeting with you, you have to answer the following three questions. One, how are you different than the others? Two, how do you do a certain thing that is a challenge for this company? And three, how are you different from the solution that we've now built internally? So I had to then go and actually do some research on this. That meeting was a blasting success. So instead of spending half an hour with us, they postponed some meetings afterwards. We spent almost an hour together. We're still talking to that company. We're scoping a pilot now, right? Because once I get in front of these companies, I can show them how we're different. But to get in front of this company took me months and months and countless requests. I almost considered going to the headquarters and just walking in. You know, it's really, it takes persistence and endurance to do it.
Yeah, and I love persistence. You know, we've talked about persistence before, and no doubt, you know, if we get the time, we're going to talk a little bit more about persistence and grit and whatnot. But yeah, absolutely, you're absolutely right. You've got to understand that other people are busy as well. But more importantly, especially in the tech world, we all sound the same. You know, unless you can make yourself different, like they said, what makes you different? What makes your solution different? And what makes it different to what we already know? Because if everyone's coming on and saying, we do this, we do this, we do this, you're just going to sound exactly the same. So what I want to ask you is, how important do you think it is for your company to be seen as a leader in sustainability so that you can actually stand out against all the others?
I think I'm not sure how I would answer that. I think a leader is what, it's certainly in our mission, right? So as every good startup, we have our vision and our mission and whatnot. And I think our vision is that we want to be the industry standard, the standard setter, basically for supply chain decarbonization software. Now, we are clearly not the leader right now because, as I say, there's a lot of companies. Some are better equipped with money. They have collected more funding. They have more customers. They are older, et cetera, et cetera. So I think my answer would be, you have to be the leader for a certain thing, right? And, you know, even what some of your listeners might think is very specific, which is supply chain decarbonization. I mean, how much more specific can it get? But even within that, there's different challenges that companies have, and they're even more specific, right? And one could be that many companies, they cannot find out what materials are in the things that they buy. It's such a specific challenge, but a lot of companies struggle with it. If you manage to convince people and companies that you're the best solution for that particular challenge, that is what opens the door, right? And I think that's something that we've learned over the past couple of months, that being the best solution for individual challenges within this overall construct of scope 3 or supply chain decarbonization is what gets companies interested. And then from there on, you can expand. You can then convince them of other features that you might do as well or better than others, but you have to be really the leader in one particular feature that these companies struggle with.
You know what, Alex, I couldn't agree more of that. And I think that there's this misconception that in order to be the leader, be the authority, you must be the authority as the overarching authority above everybody. And that is just really a big, big cookie to eat. You just can't do that. It's like trying to swallow a whole elephant, no matter how long you've been in the game, because there's always going to be the big four in any industry that's going to claim that title. But as you said, if you can become the authority or the leader in one particular problem that gives one particular outcome that solves it for them, then you claim that space and then you can grow from there. Is it so? You know, the message I suppose here would be is that don't let the fact that you're small stop you from trying to claim your piece of authority within the industry, because you can certainly claim that if you're focused towards that and be known for one thing. You might do a lot more, but actually be known as the leader for that one thing. And that's a tremendous lesson to get to share there.
I would also say put yourself in the shoes of the corporate buyer. If you're trying to convince them that, you know, in my case, we're the best carbon accounting platform out there, they will rightfully say, like, guys, there's a million out there of which half are older and more experienced and more mature than you are. Why should I buy you? Like, literally, not why should I even try you? If you can go there and say, like, well, you know, you have your carbon accounting and reporting platform, we appreciate it, but don't you have that problem X, right? In this case, that you can't really get good insights on the materials and the components that you buy. And if they say yes, then you say, like, well, why don't you just try us out how we can help you solve this problem? And we'll even play nice with your carbon accounting reporting platform and we integrate with them. You don't have to kick them out and use us. But that is where you start. And that is where you really help them solve a problem. And that is ultimately what then convinces them to try you out and perhaps you to buy your solution.
Yeah. Finding that little dent in the armor that you can go in there and then you can start exploiting that dent. And I mean exploiting in a nice way, not a nasty way. But going in there and say, hey, look, there's a little, it's almost like fixing a puncture. There's a little air in there. How do we get in there and solve that little puncture? The big problem is the flat tire. But the actual problem you can solve there is a little hole as a puncture that actually fixes it. So let's talk about attracting clients then. As I said, you've got to have that conversation. I know for you, it's an absolute, this is why I love chatting to you, because it's always a combination of action and persistence with you. You know, it's very much, hey, this is what I'm doing. I don't sit on my laurels. What methods have you chosen that you are currently using as a startup to ensure that you are getting in front of people? Or people at least putting their hand up and saying, hey, I want to talk to you.
Yeah, we're trying a lot of different things. And I think marketing is almost our number one priority now in Q1, right? I think what is helpful is clear communication. And that is also something that evolves constantly. So when we started Teralytic 2 years ago, coming out of 10 years at McKinsey, talking to some of the biggest companies of the world, we thought we knew and understood what the market and what the customer needs. Fast forward 2 years, I realize even now I don't fully understand it, right? We have, in the meantime, talked to literally hundreds of practitioners in that area, to companies, etc. And we've gotten a lot smarter. And guess what? Every startup will confirm that, but like our initial idea was wrong and we've pivoted 3 times since then. And I think what we have now is a lot better. But I would still not claim that what we have now is perfect, right? So it's a constant listening to customers. I guess maybe that's the summary of all of this. Make sure that you talk to a lot of customers, that you listen well, and that you have some structured way to collect that feedback, to structure it and to turn it around into what makes up your start. What's the product? What of those things that we've heard over the past couple of weeks should actually make it on the product roadmap? Because apparently they reflect a common pain point. How do we actually define the pain point? How can we communicate it in a way that the customer recognizes themselves in there? I've just learned this week that, you know, opposed to my optimistic mind, which is always around opportunities, customers react more to the pain itself. Rather than telling, like, look, all the great things you can do on our platform, you should rather communicate, like, here's all the problems we solve for you. So there's just certain things around understanding your customer, really boiling it down to what are their main pain points, communicating those well, and then provide a solution for that. And that you have to get in front of as many customers as possible. And that's the process we are on. We're trying to move away from cold. Cold, in my experience, like cold sales, cold outreach, has not been super effective. I think what we're trying right now is really going via content, providing relevant and interesting content on LinkedIn, in conferences, webinars, etc., and then having customers find us based on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is a philosophy, as you well know, that's what we do here at Authority Accelerators, is making sure that you are giving good educational-based marketing content out there so people come to you as opposed to you doing the chasing. But one thing I want to pick up on there, which, you know, you said it with such grace, yet it could be missed, is that especially in tech, the belief is if my product or my service is great, they will buy. And it isn't about how good it is. It's about how it solves a problem. That people buy from pain, that they want to stop something. You know, it's got to either make me more money, it's got to save me more money, or it's got to keep me out of jail for compliance. What is the problem that you solve and the pain that they're going through, and then work your message along that? Because like you're doing right now, people will buy if they're in trouble, or they've got a pain they need to solve, or their boss tells them that has to change, as opposed to here's a new shiny object that looks better, bigger and better than everybody else. You know, it's a very, very good point on that. Let's talk about sales cycles. You've mentioned before, obviously, in closing deals can take, you know, 9 months, 12 months, or whatever the case may be. What advice can you offer based upon what you know currently for founders facing similar challenges with sales cycles, not only being long, but getting longer and longer after, because they're doing demo after demo after demo?
Yeah. I mean, I'm happy to maybe share for like 30 seconds or how it works for us. So, you know, when we have a first or second conversation, it's typically around demo, right? And you have your first hook, you have your way in. The first person you give a demo, and typically it's the wrong person. That person is like, oh, this is cool, but let me set up another meeting with the right people. So it's almost the second meeting is almost as important as the first one, which is like, okay, the right people are suddenly in this call. You have to convince them as well. In some cases, there's even a third demo because then the boss needs to be involved as well because they're the decision maker. So all of that is fine, right? But in our experience, try to provide value as quickly as you can. So we have, let's call it a marketing instrument, where we provide a free analysis, a product carbon footprint that we do for them. And it's important that you do it for them, because if you sell a platform, they can't do it themselves without going through a lengthy tech review and whatnot. So the first one you have to do for them, that's the marketing, that's your sales effort. Then you provided some value, they see what you can do and they get interested, right? The next step for us is a paid pilot. So we say like, well, look what we've delivered. This was apparently interesting and great. Let's talk about how we can do a paid pilot. And here's where I want to make that first suggestion. That paid pilot, because it's a contract, it has to go through procurement, through legal, through everything, right? So you might as well set this up as the full contract that you eventually want to sign. And you make the paid pilot a first period with an opt-out afterwards. So basically, you already signed a license contract. You already signed a whole shabam, and it takes a while, right? Because it has to go through legal and procurement, and you have to do the tech onboarding and so on and so on. But you have to only do it once. And I think that was one of the big learning. We originally had pilots. Then after the pilot was successful, we went into the license negotiation. So we had to go through everything again. So what we've did probably shortened our sales cycles by weeks, if not month, by just making sure that what you negotiate is the final contract. There's an appendix that says we do a pilot first. And after the pilot, the client can opt out free of charge, right? But you know, it makes it so much easier for them and it makes it so much quicker afterwards. That's a really important advice, probably the biggest learning we had. And then the last, it should be self-explanatory, but still don't make yourself the bottleneck. The worst you can do in such sales cycles is that you're the one that has to send stuff. So if they answer and, you know, they're sending you something or they're asking for something, make sure to get it to them within 24 hours. Because then, you have the momentum. Clearly, you're on the mind of that person right now. If you send it back quickly, they'll continue. And then, you know, it takes weeks on their side again. But don't be the bottleneck yourself.
Yeah,
I think those are the main advices.
Yeah, I think that's some great advice there. You know, don't overpromise, you know, and underdeliver. Make sure you're, as you say, not the bottleneck, and make sure you do it. But absolutely, you're absolutely right. Why make them go through the whole procurement process again, you know, because that just absolutely delays. But then also you're doing is putting you're putting another reason for a no, for them to say no, because you've got to start all over again and all the other people now have to get involved. And that is a fantastic piece of advice. And guys, if you're not doing it, if you're listening to this, you're not doing it, do it. This is how we run our business as well. This is what we do with our clients as well, funny enough, is that, you know, we have stage one. You call it the pilot, we call it stage one. And with the stage one, and then there's an opt-out after stage one, so that we've got all the stages in place for our contract. Let's talk a little bit about collaborations, Alex. You focus a lot on collaborations with suppliers, and that's actually quite unique. How does this approach help your clients not just meet their sustainability goals with your clients, but also help them reduce costs and grow your company?
Yeah, so I mentioned these sort of very specific struggles, right? And one struggle that many companies in that particular field and area have is that in order to get really good information about emissions in your supply chain, you have to collect primary data. I think what we as Terralytic do is we help you to get the best possible data without reaching out to suppliers, which helps you prioritize which suppliers you want to reach out to and on which products, et cetera. And then we help to get in touch with those suppliers. But ultimately, that getting in touch with suppliers is, for any company that wants to make any progress, is a must. Now, what companies struggle is that they don't get answers from suppliers. And there's good reasons for that. Suppliers are often smaller and under-resourced. They don't have the capacity or the capability to give answer on complex carbon questions. And by the way, they're getting these requests from all their customers at the moment in 20 different formats. So they're really overwhelmed. And that's why they don't reply and why they don't provide this information. In some situations, they might also think that it's critical information that they can't supply because they give away too much of their secrets, right? What we find is that, first of all, starting with an answer rather than a question is a good way. Many of our competitors will send out an empty questionnaire and asking, hey, dear supplier, on behalf of our customer, we would like you to fill this. And that's the problem, right? Because then the supplier has a big question mark over their heads and scratches their head and asks, how are we going to do this? We help our customers already get to an answer without primary data. So we might as well just share that answer. That's, by the way, rooted in a lot of work on our side and some very smart approaches. But we share the data with the supplier. We say, like, look, here is what we think about your supply chain. Here's what we think about your operations, right? Based on sources that we mentioned. Please let us know where we're wrong. And by the way, here's a guide how you would figure out whether we're wrong. That approach makes it so much easier for suppliers to actually answer and to actually, you know, provide that data. And we have literally in the pilots and the work that we did with customers, we have found that this can reduce the time it takes to get an answer to your request by 75%. So in the cases that we've worked on it, literally reduced the time from like 4 or 5 weeks to only about a week. And even with suppliers that are at the very beginning of their own journey, like some Chinese suppliers that have never worked on carbon before, they found it quite easy to provide the data in our environment. And that's what excites a lot of our customers, because it saves them so much time, so much effort, so much headache. And that's one of the things that we communicate a lot, going back to your previous questions, when we talk to our customers.
Brilliant. Yeah, fantastic. Well, listen, it's been a fascinating journey and it's been great chatting to you. But I've got one last question for you, and that is this. You've had an interest in entrepreneurship, the challenges, you've run too fast, you had to dial it back, you've got the perseverance in there and everything we've talked about in between today. If there was one piece of advice you'd give founders out there today, or certainly starting founders, you know, what would that be?
I mean, the one I already gave is persistence, right? And this is I'm not a smart person to give you that advice. Like every startup blog in the first paragraph, you'll somewhere see persistence. Just show up to work every day, even if, you know, life and the industry throws you stones in the way. I mean, just continue. Like, I think the successful startups and scale-ups out there, they all went bankrupt 6 times almost. Just bankrupt, I should say. So just go do it, continue. I think the somewhat more interesting advice is also not unique, but from own painful experience, stay small and really, really sort of scrappy as long as you can. Like, hands down, the biggest mistake that we made in those past 2 years was to scale too quickly. At some point, we had a very high burn rate for the team, right? We burned through the investments we connected relatively quickly. And luckily, we caught it on time and we stopped it on time, and, you know, it helped us survive. But I think a couple more months and we would have been dead. And I think scaling and growing is great, but you should do it with customer success. So really stay small, stay scrappy, do a lot of things manual, and then only hire if, even if you collect investment, continue staying small and scrappy, and you know, only start hiring once you see the customer success coming in, and once you see the contracts come in and the revenues, etc. And then of course you can, you know, collect investment and you can have a negative cash burn for a while longer, but at least then you have the customer success and the revenues that come in to support it. What you're doing is actually correct. That's really the biggest piece of advice that I would say I took away from the last 2 years.
Yeah, and I think that's some fantastic piece of advice. And I love the word scrappy. I love that from a startup point of view. You just need to get in there, keep it scrappy. Don't, you know, there's a phrase we find a lot is that people lean over their skis too much, you know, and then they end up crashing and burning and stuff like that. But as you say, you can get investment, but doesn't mean you have to spend it. It's there that you can get these clients in first, get the cash in, get more and more cash in, and keep persevering. I love that. So if people want to get hold of you, Alexander, to know a little bit about what you do or perhaps potentially work with you, what's the best way of getting hold of you?
LinkedIn. I'm okay. Extremely active on LinkedIn. It's our main sort of sales marketing tool at the moment. And I'm pretty good in replying to messages. So yeah, find me on LinkedIn. I shouldn't be difficult to find. Alexander Pfeiffer, Terralytic, and I'll probably pop up. Title says something that I'm on a mission to reduce carbon emissions by 1 billion ton by 2030. It's a lofty goal, but everyone needs one, right? Yeah, please get in touch if you want to learn more, if you want to connect. Obviously, preferably if you're a potential customer and you want to discuss with me how I can help you reduce your supply chain emissions, you know where to find me.
Really. Well, I'll make sure your LinkedIn is actually in the show notes so people just do a one click and get hold of you. Well, thank you very much, Alexander, for joining us today. Thank you for your time and your insights, for sharing it. It's been an absolute honor having you here today.
Thanks a lot, Gary. Thanks for having me. And it was a pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us again for another fantastic episode. And if you've taken anything from Alexander today, please make sure you put it down as a like or a comment, and make sure you subscribe for more tech leaders sharing their insights. But more importantly, this is a channel for us all to grow. So please make sure that you share this episode, you share some knowledge from there so that we can all grow together. So until the next episode, thank you very much for joining us. Alexander, thank you very much. I'll speak to you soon. And thank you guys for joining us. Goodbye.